Okay, and we are live. Welcome to the seventh episode of our series, Authentic Conversations in English. Today, we're joined with a special guest being Mark Rosenfeld. He's an expert on relationships and dating. So today, we're going to simulate a realistic conversation in English about the topic of love. I know a lot of you guys have requested this on Instagram when I took polls. So here it is now. So pay close attention, take notes if you need to. And before we jump in, Mark, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show, first of all. Great to speak with you guys. So I've been working as a coach for about 7.5 years now. I predominantly coach women. I'm based out of Australia, but I've moved to the US to expand my business here. I started actually from my own social anxiety. So it was shyness. It was fear of putting myself out there. It was me withdrawing myself from social interactions, particularly with women, and finding that I was just unhappy doing it. So it started out with my own journey. And then me going forward, I started to work with other men who were in a similar sort of position and situation to myself. And I was quite young at the time. So after a while of doing this, I just kind of found that long story short, I actually got a job later on as a stripper. And so I was interacting with lots of women at the time. And I was finding that, women are actually asking for this service as well. So my business slowly evolved from working with men to working with women. And it's kind of been that way for about 6.5 years now. So that's the short of it. I've also had my own relationship journey, my own relationship struggles. I am engaged now, although technically I haven't publicly announced that. So keep it on the DL until I announce it next week. But yeah, it's been a journey for me. And so I help clients, women all around the world, basically with their own relationship journeys, moving from whatever they've had in the past to a healthy dating and healthy relationship future.
Okay, sweet. So yeah, that's super interesting. And then we have, for all you guys who are joining in, I guess you're going to be joining from YouTube or Facebook. So as you come in, you can introduce yourself, let us know where you're from. Please. If you have any questions for Mark or any comments throughout the stream, you can let us know and we'll periodically stop and we'll address them, of course. So Kevin Hawthorne, good afternoon from Lakeland, Florida. Okay, shout out to you, Kevin.
Sup, Kevin.
Can I call you? Refer to the info in the description below. I'm going to put info for myself and Mark as well. So whatever you need to know or whatever you need to receive, just refer to the link and you'll be able to contact either one of us. Now, Mark, you kind of answered the first question I was going to ask you, which is what led you to becoming a relationship coach. And I guess you kind of answered that. I was going to say, like, I guess it was from certain experiences you had, because I know some people, maybe they trip and fall into a certain industry by accident, even though it wasn't what they were intending to do, versus some people are very intentional. They say they want to do this. So would you say that, what were you originally planning to do with your life prior to, let's say, having these experiences that led you to becoming a relationship coach?
Yeah, so I've always been into fitness. 20 years, I think I've been around gyms now. So that's always been a passion of mine. And I started to want to be a exercise physiologist, which is a physical therapist in America. And I did it for a little while. I went to school for it, did 3 years undergrad, but just didn't enjoy it. I don't want to be a personal trainer. I learned pretty quickly. So I didn't know what I wanted to be at that point. And I decided, I'll go be a veterinarian. I've always got along with animals. I kind of had a thought when I was very young that I wanted to do that. Never really followed it through. So I went and got into veterinary school. Long story short, graduated veterinary school. And it was throughout sort of the middle, third to fourth year of veterinary school where the dating thing really started to evolve for me. Actually, technically, it was a couple of years earlier than that. But throughout veterinary school, that stuff was kind of growing. And basically, a couple of years after I graduated veterinary school, I was working as a vet. I had a job. The side hustle was growing. And essentially, from there, it got bigger and bigger. And I worked fewer and fewer days as a veterinarian. And then in 2019 was my last day of work. 8th of July, 2019 was my last official day as a vet.
Wow. And I guess that was a huge milestone for you, seeing how you...
It was, memorable. I filmed a whole YouTube video on it. There was a whole day of about 3 or 4 patients that day. And it was kind of like my goodbye. I still get a bit emotional watching it, actually. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's super cool. That's super cool. I saw your... And also, I would say, throughout your experience, how long have you been doing it for now exactly again?
working as a coach.
Yes.
Yeah, about 7.5 years. So I just got to get the timing right there. So I think it was more towards the end of veterinary school it was developing. The stripping started before that. That was when I started meeting the women, having these interactions. And a couple of years after I started stripping, that was when I thought, oh, you know what? Maybe I should open my business to the female side. And so it was probably about 2015, I remember, I started blogging and first working with one-on-one clients. So I guess that's pushing on 8 years now.
I see. And through your experience, what would you say is the most common issue you've seen with the people who you've advised?
Yeah, I see quite a few. There's a general complaint about I can't find a good man. I can't find where good guys are. There are deeper pieces to that. The reality is we're in a more connected world than we've ever been. You know, I can go on my phone now and connect with thousands of women without leaving my house. So we are more connected than ever. But finding someone in the rough, especially when we're so overwhelmed by the choices, that's the new challenge. You know, 50 years ago, you go out to a dance and you maybe meet three men or three women for the night, maybe six if you're really social, and those were your options. Now, you know, you can meet that many people in 5 minutes or 30 seconds if you really swipe. So there's this overwhelm that's felt, especially with online. I can't find a good one in all of this. This is overwhelming. Struggle to have people invest in relationships is a big one. You know, we kind of live in a culture now where there aren't many boundaries set for us anymore. You know, it's really easy to cheat. It's really easy to go and find a new boyfriend or girlfriend. It's really easy to kind of avoid having the relationship conversations and just go and do something stupid or go and do something else, basically. So there's lots of complaints that I get around sort of the casual culture or things, you know, men don't take it seriously anymore. People don't invest anymore. And while there's some truth to that, there is also a certain emptiness to casual culture, to cheap interactions. And eventually people do come around. But in terms of surface complaints, that's what I hear a lot. I can't find a good person. People don't invest anymore. And I'd say also that relationship skills are being lost. So I get a lot of women who come to me, for example, that say men aren't treating me the way I want. My boundaries aren't being respected. Men aren't choosing me over other women. Some of the typical dating stuff as well. I get a lot of that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. Or actually one more, I have a pattern of blank. I have a pattern of attracting blank. I have a pattern of men doing blank. Patterns is another thing. Right.
Yeah, no. What you said sounds accurate from what I can see anecdotally. I was also going to say, what was I going to ask you? So throughout this experience, what you said was really interesting about the paradox of choice, right? You have a ton of different options. You get a little bit overwhelmed and it gives you a little bit of anxiety. You have a hard time deciding what's what. That it's a common thing. And I would say it's just common with human nature in general. A lot of people always think that the grass is greener on the other side. And then they
100%. I mean, walk into an art gallery and have 60 paintings in there and be told to choose one. Mm-hmm. They're all beautiful. Oh my God, do I like that one? But it's overwhelming, right? You walk into an art gallery, be told you have three paintings to choose from, you'll walk out feeling pretty confident about your decision.
Yeah.
With 60, you're second guessing, you're not sure. After 5 days, you want to go back and switch it. You know, it's a human brain thing, as you say. So it's become a new modern age relationship skill to actually have to be aware of that. And when your brain is going, oh, there could be something better over there. Oh, she might be better in that way. Oh, he might be better in that way. You have to kind of stop because that's your brain's automatic response to overwhelming choice. You have to kind of stop and go, wait a minute, is that actually legit? Or is that just my brain doing its funky evolutionary pattern thing?
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's tough. And it really is a skill to be able to be grateful for what you have and be able to be content. It's extremely difficult to do if you're immersed in social media and you see all of these distracting things that are pulling you in different
perfect
directions.
Things but, in every direction.
Exactly. But it truly is a skill. I think I've seen the people who I see typically who are much better with that have very strong religious convictions or even cultural influences as well. But I would say that for the average person, if you're just going to speak about the 7 billion people on Earth, it's definitely difficult for the average person to do.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it's, you know, having a great partner is not about finding the perfect partner. And of course, everyone on social media looks perfect. We've all been with our real partner. We've all figured out what problems they have. We've all dreamt of them not having those problems. And then we've all seen someone on social media that we perceive does not have those problems. So you have these perfect images, perfect things, perfect relationships, perfect men, perfect women thrown at you all the time. And then you've got the one at home that has real human problems. And it creates this negative contrast compared to your partner. And that's why, as you say, thinking, what problems am I happy to live with, is a much better question than how do I get rid of these problems? But, you know, it's a paradox that I also speak to women who say, oh, you know, I really should just be happy to live with these problems. I'm sure my guy is fine. Meanwhile, they're in abusive relationships. So there's kind of there's a balance, right? You have to pick problems you can live with, and you don't want to overcorrect because you'll always be going to the next person and you'll have impossible standards. But at the same time, it's tricky because sometimes if you tell people, hey, just chill out, like accept the problems that you have, it's not that bad. Well, someone who's in an abusive relationship might hear that. And it's like, no, 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 not you. You raise your standards. You don't need to hear that. So sometimes the messages can land on the wrong ears. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Pick a partner with flaws you can accept.
Definitely. And then, yeah, like you said, getting rid of problems, it's not a very realistic solution. I think everybody has problems. It's just a matter of some people have better problems than other people.
Exactly. Warren Buffett has money problems.
Exactly. Yeah. So there you go. We got a chat here. Hi, brother. How are you? Steve Depp. Okay. Shout out to you, Steve.
What's up, Steve?
So yeah, I see you guys are asking some questions about learning English tomorrow. We're going to do a stream that's strictly related to ESL learning. Today, we're just simulating a conversation. So if you guys have any questions about vocabulary words that you may not understand, expressions or idioms that you may not understand, we can answer those questions on the stream. Otherwise, tomorrow, we'll be answering the more in-depth questions about learning English. So it's going to be that type of stream today. So there we go. And now, another question. On that note, based off what we just spoke about, would you say, in your opinion, are long-term relationships for everybody? Do you think they are potentially for everybody? Everyone could potentially and should potentially get into a long-term relationship or not?
Look, that's a great question. And there's so much we can unpack there. I think that human beings are designed to be together. We're not designed as lone wolves. We're not designed to live on our own. And we're becoming more and more of an independence culture, which is, I don't need community, I don't need church, I don't need family, I maybe even don't need a partner. And look, some of that has come because in some cases, those organizations or individuals have been pretty toxic. We've all heard of toxic churches, we've heard of toxic community groups, and we've certainly heard of toxic partners. So I get where the individual movement comes from. But do I believe at a core level human beings need each other? Yes, I do. Absolutely do. We all have emotional needs. They're not wants, they're needs. And we can't thrive if our needs are not being met. A baby dies if its needs are not being met. Adults can survive, but we don't thrive. And I'm talking emotional needs here. So do we need each other? Yes. And human beings are designed for pair bonding, specifically with one partner. Now, unpacking the question more deeply in terms of long-term monogamy is a more interesting sort of conversation. If we go on a purely biological basis, human beings are more serial monogamists. Our basic biology dictates we fall in love, the dopamine peaks for about a year to 2 years, and we're pretty enamored with our person for that time. Now, the reason the dopamine wears off after 2 years is actually two very sensible biological reasons. Number one, the children at that point can probably survive because the mother has given birth, she's raised the child, she's able to, you know, walk and look after herself a little better. So she's not as desperately needy on the man to look after her. So she doesn't need to be as enamored. The couple doesn't need to be quite as enamored with each other anymore. And the second reason is to mix the gene pool. So by mixing the gene pool, you're going to have more matches, different genetics in the pool. Partners last for 2 years, then go and find another partner and whoop-de-doo, we've got a genetically diverse pool. So if we're going on what humans are biologically designed for, then we're talking about serial monogamy, as in short 2 to 4, so more like 1 to 2 year relationships, maybe extending out to 3. That's typical human nature. So the question then becomes, is that human nature what is most appropriate to us today? Now, everyone has different attachment styles and people have different opinions on this. I personally do favor long-term monogamy because I think it makes more sense based on connections today. And because, quite frankly, I just don't like going through breakups. I just get sick of, if you're going to break up with someone every 2 years, you know, it's a real loss. It's especially if the relationship is healthy. There is growth available in relationships and being single is great. Both options, you know, they have their pluses and minuses. For the clients I work with and for my own belief system, I believe there's a lot of benefits for mental health, for growth. The benefits, especially for men, are pretty incredible if you look at the science of being in a healthy relationship with a woman. The benefits for women are slightly more mixed. But overall, the clients I work with and my own belief systems does favor long-term monogamy in the modern world. But I also understand that it's not for everyone. And some people prefer all different relationship models.
Okay, I see. And on that note, I guess, what you basically just said, you basically implied that a lot of the attachment styles are somewhat subjective, I guess. Everyone has kind of different styles of how they go about long-term relationships, I suppose. So on that note, I was going to say, when it comes to the theme of love, basically, in the dictionary, the word love, it's basically the definition that will come up is it's going to say something like an intense feeling of affection towards somebody. Do you think love is objective in that sense, or do you think it's subjective?
The definition of love that I go by is not the chemistry feeling definition. It's a definition of acceptance. So I hear a lot of people that say something like, oh, I'm just so in love, you know, the connection's crazy. I don't go by that definition because I see too many toxic situations come out of that definition. And at the end of the day, if you really love someone, then to me, you accept them. And so accepting someone comes back to the way you accept their boundaries. And this to me is the biggest test of love because, you know, one country can say that they accept another country. Oh, I accept that, my neighbors. I love my neighbors. But if they're invading that country, do they really? Not really. You can sort of talk it all you like. You can talk about the great connection. But at the end of the day, if one country is invading the other, that country doesn't love the other country. So the best definition of love that I go by is acceptance, which is if you love someone, you accept their boundaries. You accept their flaws. You accept them exactly as they are with the traits that they have. And you're not trying to change them. You're not building resentment over who you wish they were. You literally are taking them as they are and as who they're becoming. So I don't know if that fully answers your question, but that's the definition of love I use because I really believe that it needs to be related to boundaries and it needs to be related to acceptance rather than just happy fairy hormones.
Right, I see. So a lot of the stuff you touched on, it sounds good. It sounds like... it would take somebody, though, a pretty decent level of maturity in order to execute a lot of the things that you said. In your experience, do you believe that most people possess the self-awareness to actually apply the things that we're talking about? Or do you think most people in your experience possess the baseline level of maturity to potentially make this happen?
I believe that most people possess the capacity to do it. But there's trauma, there's things that get on top of that, there's a lack of education. I mean, if you were, let's go a bit darker, if you, you know, if you're abused by your parents, if you went through a lot of suffering when you were young, if you never had a model of love, it's going to feel very distant for you to get towards what I've described here today. I get that. But the alternative is just repeating your original cycle your whole life, where you're not loved because people are overstepping your boundaries, you're not respected, and you get a few chemistry highs, great, and then you crash, and the situation becomes just like it was when you were young. So I don't really see an alternative. I guess in some ways it's a little bit like a race where, unfortunately, the starting positions are just all different different places. But that's really what life is, right? We don't all start from the same position. We have different genetics. We have different upbringings. We all have a different starting position on the racetrack. And you will have different obstacles in your way to the next person and the next person. Some of us have pretty gosh darn big obstacles, not arguing that. Some of us are pretty close to, you know, the finish line just because we got our cards dealt that way. But I do believe it's possible for every person. However, there is a lot of people where it's going to take a lot of work and some years, possibly a lot of confrontation of things you don't want to confront, beliefs, trauma, inner stuff. But if you're willing to do that, it's literally my job to believe you're capable. As a coach, I always see people for who they can be, not who they are behind their blocks. That's how I think about the problem.
I see. And there's a couple of chats here. Butch says, hey, what's up?
What's up, okay. Butch?
Shout out to Butch from Twitch. And Mary Joabin, sorry if I butchered your last name there. Hi there, evening from Saudi Arabia. Okay.
Good shout evening from Vegas, Mary.
Yeah. And yeah, if you guys are watching on YouTube or Facebook and you like to support the platform, you could simply do so by liking the video. It'll help the algorithms spread the message to other people who are trying to learn English. Now, on that note, based on what you just said, so I know it's a little bit of an extreme case, but for someone who has a really traumatic background and has been through quite a bit, like you said, we all start at different points when it comes to accomplishing certain things.
Yeah.
Would you say that they're almost doomed, or if doomed is the wrong word, do you think that the probability of them recovering from such a deficit is feasible for them?
What makes you ask that question?
So I'm just thinking of individuals I know, let's say growing up, through my experiences growing up in school. Yeah. There'd be some people at your school when you grew up who maybe had a rough background, their parents had a nasty divorce, or maybe something even darker happened than that. Yeah. And then you could kind of just look back in your 20s or 30s now and look back to when you were kids and see the effect that that had on their behavior. And then you just think like, is it possible that they could probably get some therapy or possibly find some sort of way to cope with what happened? Perhaps. But have you ever had an experience where you had to deal with someone who had a...
These are such interesting questions because I think the people that follow me, listen to me, you know, they generally have at least a little bit of like a hint of a thought of maybe I should work on this stuff. Like they just even have a tiny seed of it. So I definitely interact with people who have a ton of trauma, some really tough upbringings. But for whatever reason, maybe they had an aunt that inspired them or said some empowering words one time. Maybe they're on their friend's YouTube algorithm and they saw like, oh, you can work on your relationships. So I guess the people that are coming to me, you know, have that little, at least tiny little bit of maybe there's hope. I don't tend to like labeling people as doomed because it just doesn't help my cause. It's not a belief system that's helpful for me. If I look at you and you've come to me and I judge you as doomed, how does that serve either of us? So it's not generally a label I would use on anyone, no. But I can see that there would be certain environments, people I would probably never interact with, people whose between their environments, the people they're around, and the amount of trauma they've had, and they never come into contact with someone who's hopeful. They never come into contact with that one little piece of advice that could change. And they probably never come into contact with me. Those people might be sort of circumstantially doomed, so to speak, because they will just never have an environment that gets them to the help they need.
I see. That I've noticed as well. Well, a lot of people in situations like that, sometimes they turn to religion or sometimes they turn to something else or a higher power of some sort to cope with situations like that. Yeah. I think that could work for someone in some cases. I think it could also work against people in some cases, in some ways. Just have you ever dealt with situations or clients where perhaps they were in a relationship with someone or they knew someone, but for cultural reasons or for religious reasons, it kind of clashed with them trying to form a relationship with someone else due to external purposes. Maybe it's their family, maybe it's their community, maybe it's their culture. How would you advise someone to overcome something like that? That's sort of a unique situation.
100%. Those situations aren't actually that unusual. They're pretty darn common. Relationships are three things. They're chemistry, easy, no one forgets that. Compatibility, this is what you're talking about. And relationship skills. This is some of the boundary stuff, conflict stuff. This is where I do a lot of my work. But compatibility is actually a little bit more straightforward. So there's typically sort of 9 compatibility areas now. Essentially, there's, let's see if I can get them off the top of my head. There's kids and family, whether you want kids and family. There's adult family. There's living location. There's finances. There is health and wellness. There is religion. There is, what have I left out here? Religious spirituality. There is political, has now become one. And then there's one other one that I've left off. Escapes me at the moment. But what compatibility basically is it's the core 8 areas where does a couple actually fit? Because we can have great chemistry. We can have awesome relationship skills, wonderful connection. Oh, we want the same number of kids. Oh, we even live in the same place, but we're totally different religions. And we realize that one of us wants to raise our kids super Catholic and one of us wants to raise our kids super Islam or super atheist. And compatibility issues are problems because they always trump chemistry. So what a couple needs to do is be honest with themselves, first of all, about where their values are in terms of compatibility, and then with each other about why that thing is important. So sometimes there's a middle ground, sometimes there's not. If a couple is a little bit more chill, you know, if he's like mostly Islam and she's kind of agnostic, but he's not too concerned about the kids, he just wants them to know what the Quran is, then they can probably find a middle ground that won't lead to resentment in either partner. But if he is heavily Islam, if she is totally atheist, and there is no wiggle room for either of them, then that couple should absolutely not be together. Another example is living location. I always thought that I would end up with someone who lived in the same area, but I attracted someone who lived across the other side of the world. So I had to make ask myself a very serious question. If I am living in a different place for most of the rest of my life, would I resent her? And I thought about it. I thought about the reasons that I thought I wanted to attract someone locally. I thought about how my life would look if I moved. And I had a serious thing. Would I resent her? Would I regret this? And the answer was no. So we realized that we could find a middle ground on that compatibility issue, but it's not always possible. Some compatibilities are just too deep. And religion is a good example of one that very well can be. Wanting kids, not wanting kids. That's another one where you're just incompatible 9 times out of 10. If you can find a middle ground with your partner, find it. But don't lie to yourself if there isn't one there. Just break up and find someone who's more compatible.
For sure. And speaking on that too, we actually have a question here. So ET English, hi from Thailand. Okay.
Hey.
Shout out to the Thais. Mariev, hi Mark. Here's my question. What advice do you give to those couples who are in long distance relationships?
Great question. So I actually did a long distance relationship for a year myself. And this was during COVID. We spent a year apart. Have a routine for connection. So my typical advice is 1 long date per week and a few touch bases. So in our case, it was about a 4 to 5 hour date once a week, video call, and then a few times throughout the week, little connections. Could be a 15 minute call. Personally, our thing was sort of 2 15-minute calls or 2 30-minute calls throughout the rest of the week. I think a routine connection for each other is really important. Make sure you do activities together as well. It's very easy when you're a long-distance couple to just sit there on the phone looking at each other. You know, we would play board games. We would go out and have coffee. We would do actual dates, maybe even like see a movie at, you know, at similar times if you can arrange it. Like do things that a normal couple would do rather than just sitting there looking at each other. Long distance is also a great chance for you to have more time for yourself. One of the hard parts about long distance is the distance. One of the advantages of long distance is the distance. You have more time to work on yourself. You can be fitter. You can be healthier. You can have more hobbies. You can have more going on in your life. You can make yourself such a damn attractive person that that person is just enamored by you from all that distance because you have so much more time in your week. You know, you have this great supporter from afar, but you have as I say, time, schedule space to actually do those things. So those are probably the top things. I've got a couple more videos on this with extra tips, sending each other little care packages. I did a open when envelope. If you've ever done those, they're great for long distance relationships. You open when you miss me, open when we're fighting, open when you're sad. You know, you can do little gifts like that. Have connection routines, number one. Do things that a regular couple would do, number two, and use the time that long distance relationship gives you to make yourself a more attractive person, number three.
Yeah, no, that sounds like great advice. So yeah, Mary, go check that out. And yeah, I like that. I like that idea. open when you're pissed, open when.
Yeah, cute little gifts are very appreciated.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So earlier you were speaking about people who follow certain patterns, perhaps yes, attracting a certain type of or certain archetype of person into their life. So
yeah,
if you're someone who consistently keeps attracting, let's just say, the wrong partner, right?
Yeah.
So how exactly can they break out of that psychological loop? Like, what are the tangible steps to improve their situation and stop doing that?
Number one, take responsibility. You're the common denominator. And if you keep attracting the same person, similar pattern in a different body, then there has to be actions you're taking and decisions you're making to recreate that. So while you're blaming someone else, if you're blaming men, if you're blaming society, you're not taking responsibility and you're disempowered. So first thing you've got to do is say, okay, I'm responsible for this. Now, that doesn't mean you need to pile shame on yourself and say, I'm a horrible person. I'm fundamentally broken. Get in a victim pit. This is proof I'm unlovable. No, it's proof you're doing something wrong. It's proof your actions need to change. And it's proof that you're responsible for changing that. So once you take responsibility, you're empowered. Second thing I usually recommend with this is see if you can get an understanding of why, where that comes from. 9 times out of 10, if you have a pattern, it's because that is the groove that your nervous system is familiar with. It's your safety zone. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't. So build awareness around where that quote unquote devil comes from. Where did you learn to get into this pattern? If it's something that's come up more recently, if it's a more recent pattern, then it was probably a more recent thing that triggered it. If it's been a pattern your whole life, then it was almost certainly something you learned and familiarized yourself with from childhood that led you to taking all those actions and recreating this pattern. So build awareness around where it comes from. And then secondly, how you are recreating it. So what decisions are you making and what things are you doing to recreate this? Oh, I'm ignoring red flags. Oh, I'm ignoring my intuition. Oh, I'm continuing to pick unavailable guys. So number two, build awareness around it. Number three, see if you can understand your why in those moments. What's the benefit of going back to your old pattern and really own that? Oh, when I make this decision, I feel safe. Oh, when I make this decision, it meets my need for blank. Then you know your motive. Now, from there, it kind of depends. Working with a coach or a therapist might be your next option. Once you have awareness and know what you're doing, you then need to know you need to assess what you need to do differently and just see if you could do it. If you can get awareness of, oh, this is how I'm creating this pattern, this is why, and this is what I need to do differently, sometimes having that awareness is enough and you can get out there and you can do it. You can say, no, I'm listening to the red flags this time. I'm listening to my intuition this time. I am setting the boundary this time. And you've done it and you've changed your pattern. Good on you. Fantastic. Sometimes, no matter how much you know, you just can't enact that new pattern. It feels like your old pattern is just dragging you back and you can logically know to the end of your days, but you just can't take those new steps. If that's the case, work with a professional because you've got some deeper work to do there. It's to explain it very simply, it's like riding a bike, except imagine you're riding a bike into a volcano. It's hard to forget how to ride a bike. So if you somewhere learn to ride a bike into a volcano in your dating life, it's hard to forget how to ride a bike. It's hard to forget how to do something you've been trained to do. So you've got to release that nervous system block that's causing that. And usually you're not going to be able to do that on your own. You want to seek out a coach who does body-based work or a therapist who does EMDR, IFS, that type of work. That's usually your best bet for getting in the deep stuff.
Okay. Mariev says, thank you. Okay.
Oh, thank you, Mariev. You're most welcome.
And so based on what you just said too, so look, Mark, if there's a spectrum, let's say on one end of the spectrum is extreme overconfidence to the point where you're almost delusional, right? You're just very, very confident. Love yourself, right? Almost narcissistic. Then on the other end of the extreme spectrum is like extreme humility. You radically take accountability for everything, even things that might not even be your fault. You just are radically accountable. You have a lot of humility on this end of the spectrum. Which side would you lean towards more when advising people on how they should, what type of attitude they should have going into dating and having relationships? Should they be more on the overly confident side of the spectrum, or should they be more on the more humble side of the spectrum in terms of their attitude?
I guess it depends what type of clients you're working with. You know, the extremes of those spectrums are extreme narcissism and extreme victim, both of which are extremely unhealthy. So I know you're not talking about that. I think you're talking more about, do you want to lean on the side of sort of not doubting yourself, or do you want to lean on the side of slightly doubting yourself so you can learn? I think this is one of the great balances we need to achieve as humans, because we can't grow without some self-doubt, but we can't lead and be confident without some level of self-assuredness and confidence. So there's always this balance between a little bit of self-doubt, a little bit of self-assuredness, what's too much, too little. Generally in relationships, we've all grown up with parents. We've all had experiences with our parents where we were kids and helpless. So I think the general leaning is more on the self-doubt side. My clients, at least my audience, people I typically interact with, this could be because my audience is also women, who are more empathic and naturally take on more feedback from others than a man might. That audience tends to lean a little more on the self-doubt side. And so the self-belief side is where I want to push them. That being said, if you have an obvious pattern and you're in self-confidence about it, sometimes that's when you need to lean a little more into self-doubt. I think if you're not sure for your personal situation, get an unbiased outside perspective from either a coach or several people who have secure, solid relationships built on trust, basically built on exactly what you want. Get unbiased outside opinions. Friends, if they can be honest, but ideally someone who's unbiased, who has the results you want. If you're in any doubt, a person like that will point out your blind spots. And the blind spot could be, no, you're overconfident, you have a gap here. Or it could be actually, you know, you're doubting yourself a lot and you're aiming low. You need to aim higher. So if in doubt, get feedback from trusted sources.
Okay, pretty good. And that way earlier in the conversation, we were just briefly talking about meeting people online versus meeting people in person. Now, there are many, many debates about this in terms of which one is better. Personally, I would say there are pros and cons to both methods, to be honest. But typically, I know it's very easy to say it depends, but like if you had to advise one or the other, which one would you lean towards more when it comes to advising someone who really wants to get out there and start meeting people who they may be compatible with?
Offline. Yeah. Okay. Online is really just a supplement. It should never be a substitute. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing though. If you are so busy, or should I say not prioritizing getting out, then you might fall back on online as a crutch. But if given a binary choice and you say pick one, offline every time, because if you can meet all your people offline, if you can have new people coming into your life and do it through means of either meeting people in public or going to events or setting yourself up on social, you know, expanding your social network, there's so many more advantages. Your social confidence will grow. Your self-worth will grow. Your social skills will grow. Everything grows on everything grows when you're offline. And honestly, even online works better when you're good at offline. The people who get the most success online are the people who are already good at offline. because they tend to have a little more confidence. There tends to be a little more social skills there. They tend to honestly be a little bit happier. So it's a bit water off a duck's back. So offline every time, if it's possible with your lifestyle, if you can find a way in your schedule to be meeting 3 to 5 people every week, if you can figure that out, always offline.
Okay, interesting. And do you agree with the sentiment that you usually end up attracting more people when you're not proactively trying to attract them versus when you're proactively trying to go out and attract people, you end up repelling them because you give off a little bit of an energy like you're trying too hard? Do you agree with that sentiment?
I don't love that sentiment. And the reason is, even though I think it has some truth to it, I see it give people an excuse to just sit in their lounge room and do nothing. So that sentiment is only true if you are out and about doing things. You know, it's a little bit like saying you're going to the gym and you want 6-pack abs. If you're checking in the mirror every day, do I have a 6-pack yet? Do I have a 6-pack yet? Do I have a 6-pack yet? Oh, when are we going to have a 6-pack? It's so infuriating to yourself. Now, you're not affecting anyone else with this, but imagine if you went and asked your coach every day, do I have a 6-pack? Do I have a six? Do I have it yet? You know, every single day, your coach is like, bugger off. This is annoying. If you just take your mind off the result and just focus on going to the gym and lifting the weights every day, you turn around 6 months later and it's just happened. But you're not sitting at home on the couch and saying, I don't need to do anything to get a 6-pack. So it's the same with dating. You need to put yourself in positions where you can have success, and then you let fate take care of itself. So yeah, if you're going out and you're desperately trying to make a result happen, you're desperately trying to get a woman to sleep with you, you're desperately trying to get a boyfriend, that's a problem. But if you're putting yourself in positions to meet people, if you're putting yourself in positions where lightning can strike, it's like putting up the poles. You don't know where lightning is going to strike. So you've got to kind of take, that's fate, but you are able to put the poles up to give yourself the best chance of lightning hitting and you getting your person. So I believe that you are more attractive when you take your focus off the outcome. That part is true, but it's not an excuse to sit at home and do nothing. You need to be in the trenches, getting your hands dirty, meeting people, setting boundaries, practicing your dating skills, doing that stuff. And then the result will take care of itself.
Definitely. Definitely, I agree. And yeah, just among experience, you know, I've always been a pretty observant person growing up, even as a kid. So you'd kind of look around, and that sentiment, it's something that I kind of noticed. Like a lot of people, of course, they were out and about. They were living a social life of abundance, I suppose. They had a lot of activities, which coincidentally led them to meeting certain people. But when they weren't, you know, proactively trying too hard to make something work or something like that, it would usually work out in their favor. Whereas if it's a person who is doing it inauthentically, it's very easy to tell, especially from the outside looking in. It's super easy to see it. Yeah, so
you have to be process focused. If you go out and focus on getting a woman to sleep with you, every woman's going to feel that. If you go out and focus on having fun and bringing as much energy to the room and being present, there'll probably by the end of the night be a bunch of women that want to sleep with you. But you didn't go out with the result in mind. You went out, put yourself in a situation, and then took off any agenda. That's what makes it attractive and gives you the chance to have that goal outcome.
Definitely. Mariev has another question here. You know what, guys? No matter how faithful you are to your partner, once temptation is there right in front of you, you'll still cheat. Do you agree, disagree?
I disagree, Mary, but I also want to respect your reality and that might have been your reality in the past with all men. I would also point out, if you're a client, that if you continue to believe that, your beliefs are going to determine your reality. So rather than saying this to yourself, you want to be saying something like, okay, well, I know there's loyal men in the world. How can I take the actions and have the skills to make sure I attract one, to make sure I train one, to make sure that is my reality? How can I? Is a lot more of an empowering thought pattern than this is how men are. Because this is, you know, if this is true, what can you do? You basically just get cheated on for the rest of your life, right? So you got to change your thought pattern around this. But I will say this, you know, there's tens of millions of relationships out there that are loyal. If you're seeing a pattern, take responsibility for it. When a man is invested, he will not cheat. And by the way, the statistics show that just as many women cheat as men. They just don't get caught as often. So cheating is an evolutionarily trained thing. It's a genetic pool spreader. It, as I say, serial monogamy with some cheating. Humans are a funny batch. We're all a bit mixed with the gene pool stuff. Mm. But if you're wanting to do serious relationship, especially long-term beyond that sort of 1 to 2 year mark, that does take skills. You can't just coast there and hope it'll happen. And especially if you've had this in the past, it shows me that there's not enough healthy conflict in your relationships. It probably shows me that you're choosing the wrong men. And almost certainly that you're not holding them early to the right kinds of standards and training them in how to treat you, possibly walking away when you need to. All different skills you can work on if you want to change this reality.
Well, there you go. And yeah, like you said, I mean, yeah, there are a lot of relationships where people are monogamous. So I always hate it when people kind of try to put everyone into a box, because it is true. There are many instances where obviously humans exhibit human nature and they're capable of cheating. But there are many things that can be in place to where that situation would just basically never occur. More than likely never occur, I'd say.
Yeah. And there's all sorts of situations where, you know, human nature doesn't necessarily serve us anymore, as in our exact specific biological impulses are not as helpful as they were 10 million years ago. Mm-hmm. For example, if a woman comes up to me and offers me sex now, my impulse might be like, oh, she's sexy, I should sleep with her. But let's have a look how that affects my life. I sleep with her, I get laid, then my partner breaks up with me, then I lose half my stuff. Then I'm sad and depressed. Then my business starts to fail. Does it really make sense anymore to cheat on her? That would be the dumbest thing I could do.
Yeah.
But having some impulse control is a skill. It's part of what we need to learn for relationships, for both men and women, not just to call out men here.
All right. And then, like you just laid it out, it's actually pretty logical to not make that decision.
Right.
When it comes down to it. But
right.
Yeah. And then, now, on that note with online versus in person, do you believe that there are many different schools of thought about this? Do you think that recreational intimacy is a good thing or a bad thing? What's your opinion?
As in casual relationships?
Casual relationships, casual sex, casual doing things that are known to be pretty intimate by the mainstream, I guess.
Yeah.
But, well, now the mainstream's kind of promoting casual, but do you think it's good or bad recreational relationships that don't really have a particular end goal? You're kind of just floating through
your experience. Yeah, in some situations good, in some situations bad. So let me explain the answer there. I think where they can be bad is when they become time fillers. So I speak to women who might want to have children by a certain time or who might want to be married by a certain time. Women are worried about going on dates that waste their time. But where I really see time get wasted is in filler relationships. Guys that they know are not really for them. Guys that they're maybe even not that into. But they spend months or years in these filler type relationships that burn months, much more time than you'd ever burn on a bad date. But without thinking about their long-term goals, for example, I want a family by X date. I want to do, you know, children by Y date. So I think that's where they can be bad. But I do think they can be good. Not every relationship has to last forever. There are times where we need to grow our sexual confidence. And quite frankly, sexual confidence is attractive. And it's one of the skills that can really help, especially if you're in the non-religious dating market. Sometimes if you've had a man who has, or a series of men who have treated you terribly, and you have a casual relationship that's defined by respect, that's defined by boundaries, that's defined by a man giving to you instead of you doing all the work, hell yeah. Take that for a couple of months. Have a new reference experience with a great man, even if he doesn't last forever. That's a new type of reality for your nervous system that you might never have experienced before. So in terms of sexual learning experience, in terms of having new reference experiences that are different to what you've experienced before, short-term relationships can definitely have benefits. They can also be practice areas for the skills that you need. Skills like, you know, you might have a casual relationship where you think it's going well for a month or two, but then you need to set some boundaries, have some difficult conversations, and it disappears. And it's hard, but you let the guy go. Letting the guy go and experiencing that sadness, sitting with that pain, was probably exactly the skill you need to meet the next guy who might be your future husband. So in terms of skill building, sexual, non-sexual reference experiences. I think there can be a lot of benefits to those relationships, but they can also become a crutch and they can also become a vulnerability dodge if left too long. And each individual has to make that call as to whether you're in it for reasons that are growing you or reasons that are keeping you safe.
Right. Because I mean, as men, we could probably see, I'm sure you've seen throughout your life, reasons why most men would engage in like recreational sex or recreational intimacy, et cetera.
Men want to turn down sex most of the time. Exactly. If they're single.
Exactly. It's not that deep for them. But then for women, it's a whole different ball game, of course, because I guess what we look for in each other is completely different. And unfortunately, what a guy looks for versus what a girl looks for can oftentimes be adversarial. And then it can make it a little bit difficult because you're familiar with game theory, right?
You're talking about pickup or
game theory. It's an economic theory.
Yeah.
Referring to economics. It's basically just saying, if one person, basically you're going to end up in a situation where both people compromise and don't get their optimal outcomes, or one person gets their optimal outcome and the other person gets an inferior outcome. You're either going to end up in a situation where it's lopsided or both compromise and both get a lesser outcome, basically. So it's basically like what a guy wants, what a girl wants. They could be adversarial. And then if you compromise, you kind of could end up doing business together in the economic sense or working together and having a relationship together, but you may need to compromise or sacrifice your optimal scenario, basically.
Yeah. I haven't applied that a lot, to be honest. I understand it in an attraction sense. Look, it's certainly true that the old saying, men look for sex and find love, women look for love and find sex. We can definitely generalize with that. That being said, I think men are pretty good, or maybe a little too good, at making deductions early on about where a woman fits in. There's certainly women that we go, oh, I would definitely sleep with her, but I don't know if I'd introduce her to the parents. And then we have other women that say, oh, that would be one that I could trust. That's more of a keeper. That's more of a wife material. And then we have others, again, that are friend zone. So it's certainly true that we have initial things that we come in looking for. I don't know. Human beings are just very complex creatures. And I think as we get to know someone, kind of the bets are off a little bit. And yes, each person is weighing themselves up as to their value. Like, am I getting something out of this exchange? But the weird part about modern relationships is they're also based on vulnerability, which doesn't make any sense from an evolutionary perspective. Not much anyway. There's connection sense, but in terms of being vulnerable, it's mostly dangerous. You need to really trust someone for that to make sense. So I think there's pretty sort of complex dynamics that kick in. I guess I would just say, men come in, and if we find a woman that we respect who fits that box and we're in the right phase of life and we feel like we've ticked enough boxes and we have positive beliefs about women, there's a bunch of things that go into it, but it's not necessarily that every guy is like, oh, just sex from this one. I think it's a little more complex than that, especially once you've started the interaction. Visually, before you've talked about it, yeah, 100%. But once you're in, it gets much more convoluted for me.
I see. Okay. And final question I'd ask would just be, I'm not sure if you've heard about the Jonah Hill situation, basically. You have or haven't?
I have not, no. Share with me.
Basically, he's getting railed on the internet right now because he recently got engaged to another woman. He recently had a kid, I think, with another woman. I think one of his ex-girlfriends came out. And they essentially revealed some text messages that they received from Jonah Hill. And he was kind of putting up boundaries, but there was some confusion between whether they were boundaries or whether this was manipulation of some sort. Some people thought basically his boundaries were he didn't want his ex-girlfriend. She was a surfer, right? She went surfing. She went to the beach a lot. She served with a lot of other guys there as well. She may have had some friends in her friend group who were a little bit unhinged. And then he felt uncomfortable with that. And he said, well, I don't feel comfortable with that. So if you want a relationship with me, we're going to have to change that.
Okay.
So where would you draw the line between something that is controlling versus something that is just a boundary, really?
Does the other person have autonomy to make their own decision?
As far as yeah.
He can say, you have to wear pink shirts for every day of your life, or I'm not going to be with you. Like, he's allowed to say that.
Exactly.
Say that. I think any honest woman would probably say that's not a boundary I can meet because it doesn't make sense with the long-term relationship vision that I'm wanting to paint. But, you know, there can be men who will set boundaries to cater to their own and women as well. Who there'll be people who just keep moving the goalpost with relating to boundaries. And I think this is why these situations get so much fire, because the perception is, well, he's going to ask for that boundary, then he's going to ask for that one, then he's going to ask for that one, and he's going to keep moving the goalposts until he's a total narcissist and he's kicked out every leg. He's going to tell her to stop seeing her family and she's going to lose total control over that. So that may or may not be true. I have no idea who this dude is. I have no idea if he moves the goalpost. But he is still free to set whatever boundary he likes. At some point, the other person will tell the person no, will essentially say, hey, I can go with you to a point, and then it's a no. And then the rest of it, you either take me or leave me. You either trust that I'm going to be with you and work through the insecurities that are coming up for you, or we go our separate ways. So I didn't see the text again, but he can ask for whatever he wants. But if she has the autonomy, because there is a difference between you need to stop hanging out with these people, I'm breaking up with you, threatening, or hey, babe, I'm going to be totally transparent with you. If I'm being fully honest, those couple of guys, I'm just not comfortable with them. And I trust you and I love you. They just make me uncomfortable. So I think this is becoming like a deal breaker thing for me. And if you still want to spend time with them, if that's important to you, you know, I want you to do that. Go and be with them. But I think it's just, if I'm being honest, not going to be compatible with my values and my beliefs.
That's basically how he framed it in the text. Yeah. And that's my thing. I mean, I would never call it controlling unless if you're always giving them the option to leave and continue doing their own thing. I mean, but
yeah, it can look, there's plenty of people who deliver in a threatening way. Like, hey, you can leave, but you're going to lose me.
Right.
I think there's non-vulnerable ways to deliver it. And I will say text is just not an appropriate means to have that conversation.
Yeah.
If you're getting to a point in a relationship where your boundaries are being set over text, you're so far gone at that point that you probably shouldn't be together anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, people can set boundaries wherever they want. You can set a boundary that if you don't make $1 million by next year, I'm leaving you. But you know, a lot of the time those boundaries are just being set out of the person's own fear, and the person actually, what would be best for the person setting the boundary is actually for the other person to give them a firm, like, I understand that, but that's just not going to be compatible with me. Is there a middle ground we can find here? You know, there could be situations like with exes. You know, if you're friends with an ex, that might be a situation where one person wants to be friends with an ex, the partner doesn't. So you find a middle ground, like, okay, I see the ex, but we're only friends who chat for a couple of hours every couple of months. So, you know, you put some sort of limit on it. That's kind of back to game theory. We don't ideally get what either of us wants, but we find a compromise that works for both of us in that area. If there is no compromise, then you pretty much have to break up.
Right. Okay. And so you're originally from Australia. So I've never been to Australia, but I've heard...
Gotta visit.
I've heard things. I heard it's a pretty like liberal country, similar to Canada. It's pretty, I don't know the word to use, maybe tolerant is the right word to use. But in your experience from going from Australia to Las Vegas, because I have been to Vegas and that's a different world.
It's a different, it's a wild, wild west out here. It's something, I'll tell you what. Yeah.
So, I mean, did you notice a big difference in the fundamentals of like dating and meeting people in Australia versus in Vegas and America in general? Or do you think the fundamentals basically remain the same?
So I think the interesting thing about America is every one of your states is, well, sorry, you're Canadian, but every one of the American states is quite different. It's own countries. And so the dynamics can quite change. Dating in California is very different to dating in New York. is different to Miami, which is different to Kansas, Kentucky, and
you know,
Illinois. So there's all these microcultures around here. The fundamentals are pretty well the same. Be attractive, build connection, get respect. It's sort of the same fundamentals, but there's different flavors of all of it.
Right.
I think probably one of the hardest places I have found is LA. The culture there I would personally never want to date in. But that being said, for all you who are in LA and who are saying, okay, Mark said LA doesn't work. No, there's still great people in LA. It still works for you. You can buck the trend. I'm just saying I wouldn't want to date there. Doesn't mean it can't work. I could definitely succeed dating there, all right? It just wouldn't be my first choice.
Right.
Australia is a little more middle ground with kind of everything. There's not as much variation as I see compared to the States. Does that answer your question?
Yes, somewhat. I used to date someone who lived in LA, but I think LA gets a bad rap. If you're born and raised there, I could see how you're immersed in a certain type of culture. But if you're one of the international people there, who's someone who I was seeing there, it's a different story. I know there's a lot of people from Latin America who come there too as well. And a lot of people from different parts of the world, a lot of Southeast Asians as well too. But there's definitely nuances to all the different states as well. Half my family lives in America.
I mean, Australia is pretty straightforward. I love Australia. Yeah. To me, it's a good mix between, you know, you take the girl out, you sort of wine and dine her, but she's appreciative. It's quite egalitarian. You know, women are very equal contributors, but there's still that masculine feminine polarity. I really love the Australian dating culture that way. And I don't think the American is too different, but there are these little variations in certain areas to work with. Yeah,
of course. So we're approaching the 1 hour mark, so we'll wrap it up here. So Mark, where can they find you
on social media? Yeah, you can head to my website, which is makehimyours.com.au, or I have my Queen's Club, which is basically the community. So you can find that from the website. It's called the Queen's Club, or you can head to school, that's skool.com/Q Club. School, skool.com/Q Club. That's my community where I interact, where I go live, where all my courses are, all that good stuff.
Okay, perfect. And then for us, it's just ARC English on all platforms. We're super easy to find. ARC English. We'll be launching a website soon where we'll be connecting English tutors with English students. So stay tuned for that. If you follow us on any of our social media platforms, you'll definitely be notified. So that's all for today. Until next time.
Thank you very much, guys.